You are listening to Studying Pixels, a podcast on game studies and video game culture. I'm Stefan, I'm a game studies scholar from Germany.
I'm Dan, a Japanese scholar from Texas.
And you can find us every Sunday on studyingpixels.com and wherever you get your podcasts. So E3 is cancelled for 2023. We know that already. It's been announced a couple of weeks ago. What were your thoughts, Dan, when you heard that E3 would not take place this year?
It felt like a long time coming. I think I literally thought E3 is dead. Long live E3.
Yeah.
Because I can't imagine this wasn't a discussion for a short time before it happened. I think whoever's in charge of E3 was probably thinking about this since 2020.
At least it seemed like when major publishers and developers started dropping like flies, withdrawing from the conference, that it would probably not take place. Yet, I still, even though I think that E3 is kind of redundant in those times, it's a little bit like a dinosaur that still just marches on and exists, and nobody really knows the reason for why. But still, when it went away, I just couldn't help but feel overcome by a certain sadness.
You know, we talked recently about how video games are a fast-moving and sometimes disposable medium. And I think that the periphera around video games is very similar, where I think what I felt when I heard that E3 was dead was the same thing I felt when Nintendo Power Magazine stopped printing, or when I stopped getting a subscription to Game Informer Magazine, the trade paper that we have here in the States from GameStop. So I think it's just one of those things where it's like, all right, well, there's the tombstone of that aspect of video gaming that we no longer use.
It's a painful memory, though, I must say.
Yeah. I don't know how much love I have lost for E3. I think that's where we both land on it.
I feel very ambiguous about it as well. We're going to talk about this, and we're going to retrace the story of E3 because, of course, you know, the cancellation has already happened. Opinions have been exchanged. But we want to just start at the beginning, at the inception of E3, and tell the story of the trade show as such from beginning to its, well, preliminary end. We don't know whether it's actually the conclusion or not. We'll speculate a little bit about the potential future of E3 at the end of this episode. But if you like this show and you want to help us make it happen, because this always requires a little bit of time and looking into this and putting together the script, then we would much appreciate that. You can do so by joining Studying Pixels Plus. This is where you get all of our episodes entirely ad-free, a lovely sticker that features a cute mascot Pixelcoon, and monthly Plus episodes. Some of these episodes go in-depth into video game culture, others actually help you study and research. If you want to do that and you're curious, then go to studyingpixels.com/plus to find out more.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
So we want to tell the story of E3. We, of course, have to start at the beginning. And maybe we have to elaborate a little bit on the function of trade shows as such, because E3 really was a trade show. And trade shows have always had a significant importance, pretty much for any industry, you could say. because what they would really be about as trade shows is not so much what we know now when we think of E3 or what we might remember, the big showtime moments, the big so-called press conferences that were like just showcases with Aaron Paul driving a car on stage or something like that. But it's really about connecting amongst industry insiders and video game publishers and developers, finding retailers to sell their stuff.
Yeah, it's not like the Oscars for film, because I think that's really what the Game Awards is becoming now, is another industry event, granted, but specifically to recognize the success of different video games. E3 was much more like a General Electric showroom, where it was, hey, look at our new dishwasher, or hey, we have a new washing machine. That was what E3 was, but for video game consoles.
Yeah, and you would maybe, if you had a store or a big chain store, let's say you might, for example, be called GameStop or something along those lines, then you would just go there, you would make appointments with industry professionals, with publishers and so on, and you would negotiate and you would see what kind of stock you will purchase, so that you can sell it on to customers. So it's really like a very industry insider-focused event, where also, for example, developers and artists and people who want to break into the industry would go to try and find a job. I've seen this happening a lot at Gamescom here in Germany, where people would basically just say, I want to work in a graphic design department at a video game company, so I make a portfolio and I print out my CV and I bring it along, including my business card and maybe a USB stick with further information. And then I go from booth to booth and I make appointments wherever I can, and I try to basically apply there and present myself to the company as someone who's interested in working there.
Kind of like a job fair. Come on down and see if you can schmooze a little bit and figure out, all right, Konami seems fine, I think I'll go for them.
Exactly. And you try your best and get in. And of course, there's also then the aspect of journalists who would go to trade shows and who would then report on everything that is happening there and basically tell the public about it. Because normally a trade show is something where the public would be largely excluded from it. We're talking about generally here about trade shows, right?
Although I think, I'm pretty sure E3 started that way, right? Because I don't think it was open to the public straight away. It was very much an industry kind of trade show where, as you're saying, it was just to sell product.
Yeah, it had its ups and downs when it comes to attendance numbers and when it comes to its regulations on how much of the public they would let in. But even before that, let's go back to the early 90s, before the time that E3 actually existed, because you were actually not that far off when you said it's a little bit similar to how people would show their new fridge or their, you know, home utensils or appliances. Because the video game industry for a long time did not have its own trade show, like a place where the entire video game industry internationally would come together. Instead, they were part of the Consumer Electronics Show called CES, for short. We're going to use that abbreviation subsequently. And that CES, it had a long-standing tradition. It was initially held in 1967, and it was really all about these kinds of home appliances, electronics, phones, televisions, hi-fi systems, that sort of stuff.
It's funny to think about back in 67, because in the States, you would have still had traveling salesmen at that point. And you got to figure, some enterprising individual who formed the CES said, you know, I'm tired of calling up all these individual guys. Why don't we make them come to us in Vegas? We'll pay for their rooms. We'll make them gamble. We'll make them drink. And we'll show them all of our dishwashers.
Yes.
This will be perfect.
And here you can see the fantastic new dishwasher, the D5000, like this kind of thing. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And that is what the video game industry would be a part of. It was actually held at the Las Vegas Convention Center, which is, I think, where later on most of E3s already took place as well. And so the video game industry would be a part of the CES showcase. And they were not particularly happy with that, because over time, the video game industry was growing bigger and bigger. They had a greater influence, greater capital, and thus also more, let's say, economic force behind them. And they didn't like how they were presented at the CES. I found an interesting quote by Tom Kalinske, the CEO of Sega America, who said in an interview with Christopher Dring the following, quote, "The CES organizers used to put the video game industry way, way in the back. In 1991, they put us in a tent, and you had to walk past all the porn vendors to find us. That particular year, it was pouring rain, and the rain leaked right over our new Genesis system. I was just furious with the way CES treated the video game industry, and I felt we were a more important industry than they were giving us credit for." End quote.
I absolutely understand where he's coming from. I agree with his sentiment, but it is so funny to me that, of course, it would be the Genesis just getting rained on behind a bunch of porn vendors.
Yeah. And then just like, you know, the Genesis was then quite big in the 90s. And then people would just be walking by and be like, what's that trash, you know?
Yeah.
In this very part in the back, like a small tent. Where, like, the rain's piling up on the roof and, like, denting in the tent.
Just moving past a bunch of porn stars and sleazy videos. Like, what is this? Why am I back here?
So, because of the way that the video game industry was presented at the CES, they started to gradually pull out. More and more developers and publishers said, no, we don't want to do this anymore. Instead, we want to do our own thing. And that was really the initial spark for E3. Because what they formed was the Digital Software Association in 1994. So this is 3 years after it rained on the Genesis. And the Digital Software Association is actually not so unfamiliar to us. We addressed it before in the context of discussing the ESRB, the Entertainment Software Rating Board, because it was not just the fact that the video game industry said, okay, we want to come together somewhere annually, but they had another driving factor, and that was the soaring debate about violence in video games at the time and the concerns of parents, the lack in regulation. So seeing how there would be a spark in a political debate about potentially censoring video games and giving them regulations by the government, they said, oh, wait, we have our industry organization, and we will implement our own labeling system so that you don't have to think about regulating us on a governmental level. That was really what happened after the first Mortal Kombat game came out, and parents were like, oh, geez, this is not okay for children.
1994 was a really important year for video games. And it seems like it's funny to think about something like E3 as being almost inevitable at a certain point, because of course video games are different from home appliances. But I think taking a look back, it was a pivotal move back then to legitimize the industry in a lot of ways, because every industry on the planet has a trade show, an award show, something that kind of distinguishes them as being legitimate, even down to, you know, things that you wouldn't even expect, like fishing and game, like licensures, they have trade shows, right? So little things like this are all over the place. So it was really important that they did this at this time.
Yeah, it really indicates a shifting focus and like a shifting perception of video games and their societal status. Because beforehand, of course, there would be various ways in which video games would be viewed as home electronics, basically as appliances, but also, or let's say entertainment electronics in a broader sense. Mm. But also as toys, for example. And it took quite a while for video games to come into this role of saying, like, we are actually our own thing. We don't belong with a dishwasher or a TV exhibition, or even just like, you know, toys
action
are
figures.
Us. For example, action figures and plushy toys. Of course, these all things are connected in some form. Video games are a technological apparatus that does not work all that differently from, for example, a laptop or something. And of course, they are toys that we play with, much like people would maybe play with a deck of cards or something. But it was really in the mid-90s that video games came to be recognized as, okay, so these are video games. That's its own thing. And the Digital Software Association that I spoke of, that was founded in 1994, they changed their name later on, but I'm just going to spoil it here. So for the clarity of communication, later they renamed themselves into the Electronic Software Association, the ESA. That's what the kind of abbreviation that we use today. So when you think of the Digital Software Association, just think ESA. That's what later would become the ESA that organized E3. Now, before that happened, though, they were already starting to plan their very first E3 trade show. But they tried to negotiate first with CES to see whether they could improve the conditions of the video game industry at the trade show. But the negotiations failed. I wasn't able to find any information as to why they failed, but I could imagine that there was still a lot of sentiment of like, no, we've got like the big fish to fry here. We've got like big electronics for grownups and stuff like that. And video games are more like a sideshow, basically.
I mean, I think that's got to be it, right? Because granted, video game systems are expensive, but if you're comparing them to home appliances like, you know, Kenmore Electronics or, you know, generators or, you know, bigger things that the average homeowner might be able to purchase, you're talking orders of magnitude of price a lot of the time. So my thought would be the higher ups at CES most likely said, well, whatever interest we're getting from vendors is so niche for you, you're lucky you're here at all. That would be my guess.
Yeah, it's not worth our time to say we put you in a more prominent place. That's also not...
Or even just a room with walls and a ceiling instead of a tent.
Well, but they were very wrong, actually, because the second chapter in the story of E3, I titled it Rapid Growth. Because indeed, they started their own organization in 1994, and the first E3 started in 1995, so just 1 year later. This was really a very fast organization. I assume, as it so often happens, fueled by a little bit of frustration. At least that's the sense that I get from this story, that there was this kind of stick-it-to-the-man mentality a little bit at the beginning. Yeah, at the beginning of E3, where it was just like, well, we'll show them that we're an industry that needs to be recognized. And so they started the E3, short for Electronic Entertainment Expo.
And they kind of did show them, because it was a pretty successful first year with a few notable moments, but this is something that you had found out. So it had over 40,000 attendees in 1995.
Yeah.
That's really surprising to me. I know it's, you know, later we're going to be talking in the millions of people who would go to E3, but thinking of, there are so many expos and there are so many trade shows, and the idea that 40,000 in your first go around is the number that you pull is really impressive and almost shocking to me.
Yeah. Also, you have to consider, I think we're not going to talk about millions going to E3, because E3 was always relatively small in scale in comparison to other trade shows. So when they kicked it off with 40,000, it was a huge surprise for everyone involved. And it was actually, I think their all-time high in attendance numbers, I think that was like around 70,000. So they were...
Oh, I was way off.
Yeah. E3 was never that big.
Although I'm thinking of, I mean, we'll get to this. I'm thinking of, I guess, the broadcast, the reach of E3.
You know, the reach.
That's going to many, many people. But even so, I mean, I'm just thinking of expos and conventions that I've been to. The idea of 40,000 people going in and out during the time of the event is pretty incredible.
Especially when before you were just in a rainy tent in the back of a consumer electronics show, and then suddenly 40,000 people turn up. It seems that there was a lot of interest in E3, and they did a lot of things right in giving birth to a new place and time where they would basically say, this is the get-together, the annual get-together of the video game industry at large.
There's little moments, too, that I think it was E3 hit the ground running with what it would eventually become, because I think E3 is famous for a lot of things, good, bad, or indifferent. And one of them, in my mind, is kind of like there's the event at E3. It's either planned or it isn't, but there's something that happens every year that kind of becomes the staple. And 1995 kicked it off really, I mean, incredibly. Like, it was looking back on it, it's a historical moment for the trajectory of video games, because I think that there's people who would say, myself included, that the success of the PlayStation may have been in part due to a presentation given between representatives of Sega, who were promoting the Saturn, and representatives of Sony, who were promoting the PlayStation 1. And all it took was the representatives of Sega came out and they said that the Sega Saturn, here's all the incredible things. It's, you know, you can play Shenmue, whatever. They had all of these incredible breakdowns of what the system was capable of. And then they said it's going to be $399. And in 1995, I think you could still buy a home for $399. And so then a Sony representative came out and gave the same spiel, but they were very, very deliberate in saying, and ours is $299. And so this pricing thing would later come back to haunt Sony, but their first foray into the E3 world was basically saying, our system's just as good and it's way cheaper. And I think that kind of set the precedent for a lot of E3 events, but also the trajectory of Sony in the gaming world.
Wasn't there even a show where, I don't know who it was, whether it was from Sony or from a different publisher, where someone just came up to the podium and just unfolded a sheet of paper and just said $299 and then
that's
left.
It. Yeah, yeah. It was
that was the one?
Yeah, yeah, that was it. Because of course you would. That's a brilliant business move to hear all of this stuff about the Sega Saturn. And then obviously history is on our side. We can look back and say, yeah, the Saturn, maybe it has a couple of hits, but it's not the PlayStation. And I think that a lot of it came down to that one moment of unfolding the piece of paper and just saying, yeah, ours is cheaper.
Yeah. That's really such a boss move. And the thing is, it really does set precedent for a lot of things that happened later at E3, because it shows this, it's a trade show, of course, where the industry comes together, where contacts are made, but it also had this kind of competitive attitude straight from the get-go of saying, Definitely. Everyone presents their stuff, and then it's all about who basically delivers most, who makes the most promises, who's most enticing and who's most affordable. And then you would have sort of like someone who won E3, someone who really dominated the press reports of that week.
Yes, there's always the discussion of who won E3. Always. Yeah.
Yeah. I must say, at the time, I didn't really follow E3 because I was just too young. And I probably, I don't know whether I spoke English at the time sufficiently to would have even been able to follow it. It was definitely not something that was on my mind. So I don't really have any particular memories from the E3 that took place in the 90s. But I have found out that the first E3 was such a success that they immediately tried to expand. They planned to do further E3 events, like under a label, like E3 and then a different city. They would, for example, they tried to do E3 Tokyo in 1996.
And how did that go?
Well, I mean, the reception was pretty poor, apparently. Yeah, okay. It was also the case that Sony was one of the major players in the Japanese domain that supported this, and they pulled out shortly before the event took place.
That is so funny to me. You're in Tokyo, and you're like, nah.
It's not really our thing, you know?
No. Well, I know we're...
can't do anything about it.
Can't be helped, yeah.
Well, they then stopped to try and branch off. For example, they also had something like E3 Canada planned, which they never realized, because it was just... they noticed that the attendance numbers would dwindle when they do these events in other countries and in other cities. And so they quickly gave up on that concept.
I feel like that's something that at the right time could have been successful, because so many studios are outsourced to Canada. So there's a huge gaming, development presence in Montreal and Quebec. But
it's a little bit difficult to discern as to why E3 struggled to succeed in different locations. For example, in 1997 and 98, so the following 2 years, they had to move to a different location. They couldn't do it in Las Vegas. They took place in Georgia. And apparently, the attendance numbers there were much lower than at the very first E3. One of the reasons that I found that might be influencing this is that apparently there's a lot of, there's a huge chunk of the video game industry that has their main offices around LA.
And definitely.
Yeah, so they had to basically, when they did it in Georgia, or when they would do something in Canada, they would have to fly lots of people out, bring lots of equipment there. And then many publishers, especially mid-range publishers and developers, would just say, sorry, we can't afford basically putting off on such a gigantic showcase for a week. That's why we can't attend.
I think that's the real kicker, because LA is the hub for all kinds of entertainment, and everybody has their base there. So many of the trade shows and award shows happen there that I think it's just like a foregone conclusion that if you're in the entertainment industry, you're going to have your event either in LA or Vegas, because Vegas has its fair share too, just because of the history of conventions and drawing people in with gambling and illicit activity. So I'm not surprised that it failed or didn't do as well in Georgia. I mean, even now with things like PAX, PAX are they're very spread out. They deliberately go other places than LA so that they can bring video games to other parts of the country. But they cancel them all the time. I mean, the one that was in Texas didn't do as well, so they had to cancel that. So it just depends on who's going to be able to go out.
Yeah, who's going to be able to go out, whether they have sufficiently strong players that support the show, because I can imagine this. It's like if you're a video game developer or publisher and you're thinking about attending this thing, then it's all about do you have anything to show? And usually in order to have something to show, you need to make something to show. So you need to plan this way in advance and work towards it. And you have a clear deadline as to when it needs to be submitted so that it can be shown at an event like E3 or PAX. And then you have to get all of the staff members and equipment out. You have to pay people. You have to finance their accommodations because it's a business trip and these kinds of things. Not every company can afford doing that.
It's funny you should mention that, because I put in as another notable moment that also set the precedent for future events at E3.
Mm.
The Halo 2 trailer reveal was in 2003 was so massive, and it was so different from what had happened in the previous years at E3 that it really it broke the mold, and it kind of said, okay, if you want to succeed, you have to make a trailer that's going to blow people's minds. And I think what you just said is another reason E3 kind of fell off in the later years, which was not everyone had something, but they had the time at E3, so they might put a teaser together that never coalesced later down the road. So Halo 2's massive success kind of set the roadmap for people to come in with a huge trailer that was going to get everybody talking. And that was really fun for E3, but it didn't always pan out.
Yeah, wasn't that also the time frame, like the early 2000s, where Resistance 2, the Resistance 2 incident took place?
Yes. Would you like to elaborate on the Resistance 2 incident?
The Resistance 2 incident is actually one of the early E3 stories I remember. Mm. I personally remember, because so Resistance 2 was hyped as like a new standard in, you know, technology, like a really amazing first-person shooter. And I think it was Sony who showed the Resistance 2 trailer. And it was very cinematic. It was impressive. And they kind of made it seem like as if it is all gameplay.
Mm.
However, the trailer was merely a fabrication, a pre-rendered fabrication that would simulate or kind of give you an idea of how this game might potentially look. That obviously didn't work out. And ultimately, the game came out much to the disappointment of players, being like, but this is nothing like what you showed at E3. Yeah.
Which, again, is crazy, because the Halo 2 reveal was just in-engine, you know, showing things that happen in the game. So obviously, if you're a person going to this trade show looking to buy wares for your store, or if you're somebody who's interested in the video game world and you're watching all these trailers, you have no reason to disbelieve that that's what it would look like. And then all of a sudden, you had a huge reason to disbelieve trailers. And it was called Resistance 2.
Exactly. That was the time when these discourses were just forming. We're talking about the early 2000s here, where these labels of, you know, created in-engine or it created in-game or something. These things that are indicated in every trailer nowadays or does not represent gameplay or something.
Yeah.
These inserts, they developed at the time out of necessity because people felt betrayed. And this is something that actually lasted as a through line for many years. For example, I remember that with Watch Dogs, where Ubisoft announced Watch Dogs and they had this amazing trailer where, what's his name? Aiden Pierce, the protagonist of Watch Dogs. I'm surprised that I even remember that guy's name. where he walks out of a store and then it's like, you know, the wind is blowing and his coat is like flapping in the wind and it's all so atmospheric. And then it turns out that it was actually just completely fabricated for the sake of presentation there. And they eventually had to dial it back significantly to accommodate the vastness of the open world. The game looked much worse than it looked on stage at E3. So people started to kind of develop a distrust and I would also say even a certain resentment, including myself, towards these big presentations at E3 where people would try to basically sell you things like sell you a magic tonic.
Yeah, it was. It was like snake oil salesman.
Yeah, snake oil, yes.
And I think that we're getting a little ahead of our timeline here, but this is important to bring up in the trailer space because I really do think that exact kind of ill feeling towards E3 contributed to its decline because what you would eventually start saying is this was no longer a show where you would say, oh, I can't wait for this game that's going to come out that I know will come out that I will be excited for. It eventually became, yeah, all the trailers looked interesting, but I'm not holding my breath for any of them being real. And even if they are real, I don't think they're going to play like that.
Yes, exactly. But as you said, we have to take a couple of steps forward in the history of E3 first, because in 2005, E3 basically hit the new attendance record, 70,000 people. And this would actually remain, I think, the biggest one. I'm not sure. I think this is the biggest one that ever took place.
Pretty impressive. 70,000 people.
Yeah, 70,000 people. It's always interesting, right? E3, it had at this time established itself as the place to be for the video game industry. Mm. It had obtained the power to kind of dictate the annual rhythm of announcements. And it would just be like... everything in the video game industry, or a lot of things in the video game industry, would basically march of the pacing of the E3 by being like, we have to develop our prototype by this point so that we can show it at E3. We have to have a release date so that we can announce it at E3 and these kinds of things. Interestingly enough, because of the attendance numbers, 70,000 attendees is actually, in the larger scale of things, relatively small. For example, Gamescom here has around 300,000 people every year. So Gamescom is huge, but there's also... Gamescom is internationally less important. It has gained a little bit of traction, especially since Geoff Keighley always comes to Gamescom and does a showcase there, the Gamescom opening night live. Yeah. But... there's always been a kind of imbalance between attendees, physical attendees on the one hand, and let's say reach, impact factor on the other. Because while E3 has always been on the scale of international video game trade shows, like moderately sized, I think Gamescom is much bigger, Tokyo Game Show is also much bigger as far as I'm aware, while it's moderately sized, it has a huge reach and huge impact because it's just that all eyes are on E3 for that 1 week, usually in June, I think.
June, yeah.
Yeah.
And for better or worse, because of that reach, it was this kind of snake eating its own tail where there had to be, because there were successful moments of spectacle, there had to be spectacle every year.
Yes.
I'm thinking about in 2004 when Miyamoto came out on stage dressed as Link with his... you know, to announce a new Zelda game. Like, that's a big deal to have the face of Nintendo come out as one of the characters. So even little things like that, that in retrospect seem kind of silly, were huge. And they were really important things that E3 would do. So the conversation started being, all right, forget the trailers. Like, what else is going to happen? Who's going to be at E3? What's going to be announced? Are we going to get a new console? There's rumors of this game, whatever. It became this whole behemoth outside of itself.
Yes, definitely. And the interesting thing is, it became that in its international reach. And of course, with, I would say, a particular lens on the showcases that took place. Mm. Big 1 hour, between 1 and 2 hour long showcases where publishers would just fire out one announcement after the next. But of course, this is also a physical event that takes place and where people actually go. And since it had grown so much, it kind of it kind of had the expectation that if you go to E3, then the industry has to present you with something. They have to set up all sorts of consoles so people can play the new games. It's almost like a temporary theme park for all things video games that takes place there.
It kind of turned into, at a certain point, it almost became indistinguishable from Comic-Con in the States too. Because Comic-Con, back in the day, it wasn't a trade show, but it was just like, I'm not kidding, a bunch of nerds with their comics coming to trade them. That's what it was. And then it slowly gained traction as this bigger industry event, to the point where you have celebrities there, they're talking about their new movie, it's a big trailer reveal thing. So very similar to E3. E3 felt the same way, where it stopped being about, here's our PlayStation, this is what the price point is, and it very quickly became like a circus, really, at a certain point.
And that can be a problem. It actually turned into a problem. And publishers and developers, at least some major publishers and developers, complained about this. Because, of course, if you have the situation that you've got 70,000 people around, including many people just from the public or bloggers and stuff like that, we're talking about mid-2000s here, then it got harder for them to basically find their target audience. Mostly, they wanted to speak to retailers and focus on selling their stuff, getting it onto the store shelves. They wanted to make deals. They wanted to maybe form new corporations or consider new acquisitions of other... A publisher might consider an acquisition with a studio and there might be negotiations going on and things like that. That all kind of went into the background as the event became bigger and bigger. And then in 2007 and 8, they took a radical turn. They basically downsized E3 by force. They can do that, of course, because they are the video game industry. The E3 is kind of the trade show of the video game industry. They can do with it whatever they like.
Yeah.
And they then called it the E3 Media and Business Summit. Deliberate naming. They give it a particular tag. It's no longer E3. It's the E3 Media and Business Summit. To make very clear, if you want to attend, are you media or are you business? And if you're not, no, you cannot. You cannot attend. And that's actually, they communicated this very clearly and they did downsize it. I think in 2008 was the lowest attendance number of any E3, and that was 5,000 people. So that would be a very small trade show focused on insiders and maybe then a couple of journalists who are allowed in. I've got exclusive access.
You know what's funny? You mentioned earlier you didn't, you know, remember the 1995, the first E3 with the PlayStation reveal and the premature death of the Sega Saturn. But I remember this. This was my first, I think, conscious memory of E3, of knowing about it and kind of thinking about what it was the announcement that people were no longer, the public was no longer able to attend. It was this, all right, now it's just journalists and it's just people in the business. Because I think that was a huge deal at the time. Because if you look at the numbers prior to this decision, I mean, that's downsizing by quite a lot just to get, you know, the appropriate people, you know what I'm saying, appropriate to E3 and their organizers into the event.
Yeah, to get only the people that you want. It's tough. And that was actually also a time that I consciously remember, because I do think that I wanted to, when I was younger, I wanted to go to E3. It was kind of like a dream of mine, as for any young adult who loves video games and always like hears of all of these announcements and watches these showcases. And there are people in the crowd that are cheering and you think, why can't I be there as well? And I remember that it was clear fairly early on, no, you can't go there. This is only for if you work in the industry or if you are in the media. Well, you know, later on, I actually was supposed to be sent to E3 once.
That was many years ago. I don't know this story.
That was by an online magazine where I worked. It eventually fell through because they wanted to send, I think, two people or something, but they found that it was just very expensive. And they, I mean, I already had a passport, you know?
I was expecting, I don't know what I was expecting, maybe a little more to the story, and then it's just the pragmatic, well, it was very expensive.
It's just like, you know, Googling, you know, and then, you know, flight scanner.
Oh,
and then
yeah.
Like, oh, sheesh.
Yeah, that's more than
about
we were thinking.
That thing we organized with you. But I think they did it the following year, though. I think they sent people the following year, but by that time I'd already quit.
They saved up the money. Yeah.
No, but E3 became very small, and immediately afterwards, very big again. Why? Because they found that once they had downsized it significantly, it came more into this actual trade show function, but they had an internal kind of internal conflict, I would say. This was already the time in 2009, when it became very clear that E3 as an event was conflicted. It was always kind of torn between being a trade show for insiders and being a huge public event. And in 2009, the latter opinion was dominant. The ESA, they realized that they want to be open for influencers and bloggers and, let's say, the wider circle of industry professionals. And so they opened it up to the public again. They basically changed concept once more, and immediately the attending numbers soared again. In 2009, it was 41,000. And then skipping 10 years ahead in 2018, it was 69,200 again. So basically within these 8 or 9 years here, between 2009 and 2018, they steadily increased their attendance numbers and climbed back up.
It's funny to think that they had the same kind of band of attendance, right? Because it started at 40,000, it peaked at 70, and it was always in there when they opened it up to people. So say what you will about E3, there was and is, I think, a hunger for this kind of event. People do like the celebration of video games. It just maybe stopped being E3, which is a nice segue.
A nice segue into our break, and we will be right back.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And we are back talking about the story of E3. We were just talking about the, let's say, formative years in which E3 came into what we now it to be nowadays, or what we now that it was the last couple of years. So right. Between 2009 and 2018, it established itself as the major player in the video game industry again, being the trade show that everyone would attend, that all the attention would be focused on, that would kind of attract all of the big announcements and reveals. I have actually some fond memories of this time. For example, I always have to chuckle when I think of the time when Microsoft presented their new console. I think that was the Xbox One, right?
It was, yeah,
the Xbox One, and they were just focusing on making it a multimedia device and talking about all the things that you can do by changing the channel with a voice command and these kinds of things. And people were just like, oh, okay. And then they were like, yeah, and because of, you know, the copyright protection, it's all like strictly regulated. And also, you have to always have the Kinect plugged in. I think that's what they also announced that year.
Kinect is plugged in. It's always online. It's going to tell you that it cannot open the pod bay doors and that you're trapped.
Yeah.
It's all kinds of nightmare fuel.
That was really a very interesting year because Sony had their conference afterwards. And I remember that when we were discussing it back in the day, we were debating whether Sony had all of it pre-planned or whether they potentially just waited to see what Microsoft would announce and then basically adapt because they can still change features of their console. And they saw the negative response to the Microsoft presentation and that people were kind of like, having this attitude of like, okay, maybe this is just what the new console generation will be like, and maybe there's no way around it. And then Sony came out and did exactly the opposite of making it a quite open console, cheaper than the Xbox One. They had a fun trailer where they basically showed, Microsoft had a trailer where they showed how you can share a game with a friend. And it's like this intricate system where you have to legitimize that you can let a friend play your game. And Sony did this video where it's just like, you know, handing the other person the disc. And that was it. That was just amazing. For me, as someone who's a Sony pony, it was one of these years where it was just like, I just can't believe this is happening.
I think I've mentioned this on the show before, but 2013 was also the year when the anime Attack on Titan was huge. And there was just, oh my God, I remember after E3, there were so many GIFs and YouTube videos of like the Microsoft logo on one Titan's face and then the Sony logo on the main Titan's face just beating the pulp out of the Microsoft logo.
Yeah.
And it was, I think, the perfect spiritual successor to the moment of unfolding the sheet of paper with the price point in front of Sega, because it was just the king of reactions to say, yeah, let's show how you can share a game on the PS4. You just hand it to your friend.
It was really beautiful, but it was also something that soon came into troublesome waters, because what we are delineating now, and of course we're relishing in these moments, it's a little bit like watching a sports game where you would have this major league that takes place in that 1 week and everyone's kind of basically firing out everything they got, and then there's a winner and you're kind of like rooting for someone. Because you have a PlayStation at home, you want obviously to see that PlayStation exceeds all expectations, whereas you want to see Microsoft to be kind of sneezed at. Now, the thing is, that kind of concept, it started to slowly but steadily erode since 2013, because Nintendo and Electronic Arts, they gradually removed their presence from E3. They initiated their own events. There was the initiation of the Nintendo Direct and of the EA Play. And My guess is that one of the primary reasons for why they did this is just because if you go to E3, you have to compete with the major players who will do everything they can to attract as much attention as possible to their products. And if you can't compete, then you'll basically be drowned out because any article that's published on you will be immediately disappearing in the feed. And so if you have your own event, you can dictate the time a little bit better. You can say, okay, we're not going to announce it right now. We don't have everything prepared, so we'll just wait 2 weeks. You have full control over what's going to happen at this event, and you don't have to basically wrestle for every second of attention with all the other big players.
And it's no surprise that Nintendo kind of led the way with that because, you know, Nintendo is the video game company still to this day. I would make that argument. And at a certain point in 2013, and then they took this idea and ran with it in the later years. They said, we don't really need E3. You know, we kind of are our own hype machine. So we'll do our own work, and we don't necessarily need the trade show to help us along with that.
Yeah.
I think that in my memory, the last big year for E3, where I feel like everything was kind of successful in its own right, was 2015. Because I remember 2015, I was in Japan at the time, and it was massive, like trailer after trailer after trailer of these insane reveals. And, you know, Final Fantasy VII Remake, Halo 5 and the Master Chief Collection for Microsoft. And Nintendo had a slew of titles that they were kind of showing off. It wasn't the Switch reveal, but it was a lot of, you know, titles that people were excited about. I mean, it was Super Mario Maker. That was when that was coming out. There was a Mario Kart game, I believe. So it was like, you know, big Nintendo titles. And that was really when I think things were, everybody was still involved. Things were pretty big and exciting. And that's when I remember it sort of saying, okay, now people are pulling out and it's all the rats are leaving the ship.
Well, I mean, the Final Fantasy VII Remake reveal, actually, that was legendary.
Yes.
I remember.
Unexpected.
Unexpected. Nobody expected it. Apparently, even the director of the game did not expect it because he just found out by seeing his name on the screen.
Yeah.
And the thing was that nobody in the audience expected it either. And I remember distinctly watching that E3 PlayStation showcase. And it was just such a goosebumps moment when suddenly everyone realizes, like, wait, this could this be Final Fantasy VII? And then you have this reaction of, no, it can't be. They wouldn't do this. I know it's such a classic. They wouldn't touch that. And then suddenly it comes on with the logo and you see the first character models and people are just like bursting out in tears because of the strong connection they have to that video game. And then there are all these online compilations of people crying and breaking down watching that trailer. It's absolutely impressive.
Especially because another moment in E3 history was the quote-unquote reveal of a Final Fantasy VII remake on the PS3, which was just a tech demo to show the PS3's capabilities. So I think everybody was like, it was the longest con in video game history. No, it's real now. And even the director is surprised that you're seeing it.
That was such a legendary moment that people spoke about it for weeks and nobody could believe it. And I remember how much we speculated about Final Fantasy VII Remake, what it would be, what it would be like. And oh, wait, they turn it into 3 games? Are they insane? And then it all came together in the end, of course. but yeah, I think you're right. That was the time when there were these major peak moments where you could see that it still worked. They still had the fire going. And then, though, I mean, Nintendo slowly started to pull out. Sony started to shift perspectives in 2017, so shortly thereafter. They went in a different direction. They were still at E3. But the thing is that the conventional strategy would be to bring as many exclusive video games as possible from all sorts of different genres to attract all kinds of audiences. Ideally, you would have at least 36 trailers, and every second trailer had the logo like, you know, exclusive or something, or console exclusive before, or like worldwide reveal, something like that. Mm-hmm. Now, Sony in 2017 went into a different direction. They focused on a smaller scale presentation. They selected, I think, three titles. It might have been two or three. That was the time when the new, the rebooted God of War was announced. And it wasn't announced. It was presented there. And a couple of other titles. And they had like a smaller hall. They had an orchestra that would play throughout the entire showcase. And they would show a lot more material, consistent material of these games, where you just see 15 minutes of uncommented God of War footage accompanied by a live orchestra. And I mean, people were really enthralled. I really loved that kind of thing because I always held the position of, don't give me these like super fast edited trailers. Give me five minutes of consistent gameplay so that I can get a good feeling for what this game actually is. And they did exactly that. And it made me very happy, but it also showed that E3 was like, it was drifting apart. Nintendo dropping out, Sony saying like, oh, we're actually not going to compete in this race anymore. We're going to do a little bit of a different thing. Microsoft really was the only company at that time that really, Microsoft, Ubisoft as well. They were, but Microsoft as the only company that also published hardware that was saying, here, we're going to do we got 70 announcements for you today.
I think, yeah, that was, there was something, I think pathetic would be the right word. And I think that kind of rippled out into E3 more broadly, because as you're saying, Nintendo was pulling out because of obvious reasons. They're Nintendo. They don't need anybody. Sony was kind of proving that, I think, where they are now, which is Sony is the beautiful cinematic game company. Things, you know, the games that they put out, these incredible broad sweeping narratives that have these incredible emotions. I mean, like an orchestra playing in real time with imagery of God of War is totally on brand for what Sony is nowadays, I would say.
Yeah.
And then you have Microsoft. And Microsoft is, you know, buying out all these companies. It's desperately trying to say, this is what we have. This is where we're going. They're showing cars on stage for Forza games. I mean, it's all over the place. And I think, I would say, it reeks of desperation in the sense that they don't really have anything to present. They just have kind of the hope of things, or the kind of gesture towards things. And there was something about that around this time in 2017, 2018, that I feel like rubbed off on E3, because it, you know, it's not just the big three, Microsoft, Sony, and Nintendo. It's the other publishers as well who were there. You mentioned Ubisoft and, you know, different companies like that who have their own kind of showcases. But there was just something about two of the big names pulling out or distancing themselves, and Microsoft really vying for people's attention, where I think people started saying, like, what's happening with E3? Why am I watching this?
Yeah, I think, first of all, I think it's really important that you point out we're talking about all of these major players. But of course, there were many more companies, publishers, and so on that were present at E3 that had held either small showcases, or they were just there on the show floor and were not part of these major showcase events that were broadcast internationally. There was also the addition of Devolver Digital, who joined E3 and who always did their own kind of counter showcase, you could say, where they would, you know, poke fun at E3, and they would basically be the voice of people that don't like E3 at E3.
At E3.
Yeah. Whereas with Microsoft, I would say, I mean, I think their strategy was just different. Nintendo was kind of, you know, diverging, which is, as you said, completely unsurprising. Sony was articulating a new identity for itself of being like, we are the Sony of God of War, The Last of Us, Horizon, and so on. These are our productions these days. This is what we do, and that's what we focus on. Whereas Microsoft still tried to basically stay on the track that they had already established. If we have lots of studios, we then purchase a lot of indie developers and support indie developers by doing so, and then present their games. We're basically a conglomerate of various different developers. And I think it made sense at the time because the other companies were steering in different directions. And so they could potentially just hold their ground, which they do till this day. They are still that very company, including this most recent acquisition of Activision, that's still a bit under fire, but looks like it's going to go through. So they still holding on to that kind of company identity, and not unsuccessfully so. I mean, they are still a big platform, though arguably, of course, the PlayStation and the Nintendo Switch are much bigger than the Xbox Series X, for example.
Yeah, I think that, yeah, that's a fair point to make. I'm ragging on Microsoft a little bit. I just have these, this is maybe the problem of E3. I have these memories of Microsoft's showcases being, I guess lame is the idea that I would go with. I think there wasn't as much spectacle to the other, there wasn't as much spectacle to them as there was to the other companies. And I think that kind of middle of the line, more like almost a CES showcase, has kind of put a sour note in my mouth when I think about Microsoft, which is a weird situation because it's all the result of E3 and previous years kind of priming me for what an announcement should be or what a big company like this should be presenting. And I think that my view of it is not so foreign to a lot of people's views on it, which has kind of contributed to E3 not doing so well in the past couple of years.
Yeah. I mean, there were also, I've also got terrible memories of other showcases. I remember that, for example, the EA showcase, that was always one that I found the most boring because it was just, here's the new FIFA. Here's like, we've got this new technology where the ball behaves slightly more physically realistic than in the previous games. And here's the new player that's going to be on the cover art, basically. and then lots of racing. And then there were these Square Enix showcases. They didn't exist for very long, but they were very peculiar because they were really, their showcases, they were designed like an actual trade show. Like someone coming on stage being like, I have a PowerPoint presentation prepared.
I have a lanyard that I'm still wearing.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, very Japanese of them, I suppose.
Yeah, you could clearly tell that they were coming there and they were not going to be pompous and do some kind of big thing, primarily also because all of their big stuff had already been shown on the Sony showcase.
Yeah.
So they were just like, you know, talking a little bit about some details. And of course, there was Ubisoft, legendarily, always a Just Dance showcase.
Yes, always, always.
Yeah.
Always a Just Dance showcase, and usually, as you mentioned, a trailer that was not so honest about what it was.
Yeah.
With really poor acting in, you know, real gamers playing the game and acting as if they're discovering things for the first time. That's what I associate with Ubisoft.
Well, we indicated now that E3 is kind of, it's not in decline because attendance numbers are still rising and it's still receiving a lot of international attention. But in 2018, Sony opted out of E3 for the first time ever. Like they had been there from the very beginning, every single year, sometimes more, sometimes less successfully so. But that was the year where they said, no, we're actually no longer doing this. They then established their own showcases. I think they had like the PlayStation Experience thing. And then they had like this, State of Play. This digital showcase. And of course, in 2019, there was an incident that took place that kind of eroded the trust between the press, the media, which obviously are an important part of every E3, and the organizers of the E3. Because in 2019, that was a time where Gamergate was still ongoing. So it was a time where there was a lot of outrage. Professional journalists and outspoken critics faced a lot of hate online. And E3 made, well, I'm not going to frame it normatively. E3, they accidentally leaked a list of 2,000 journalists, including their private data that they used to register, such as home addresses, email addresses, and so on. And many of the journalists that were on this list, they reported then afterwards being subjected to abuse, to hate messages, and death threats that happened subsequently. There was also another list of 6,000 E3 attendees that was also leaked. This was all in the context, if you wonder, of how could this happen? I don't think it's quite clear why it ever happened, but these lists, they were basically publicly accessible on the website. And presumably, someone who maintained the E3 website accidentally made it publicly available. Of course, these lists were immediately taken down after they became aware that this data was publicly available, but it did kind of it rippled in the discourse, and it indicated a fracture in trust between the video game media on the one hand and the video game industry on the other.
Unsurprisingly, I mean, that's a pretty big blunder, especially so recently. I mean, you would think that an organization like the ESA and a production like E3 would have more in place. And I think that really did, as you said, eroded the trust between, I mean, it was only, they were catering towards business people and journalists. That was their primary group that they were attracting. Obviously they let more people in as time went on, but that was still their bread and butter. And if I were a journalist, I would have been completely alienated at the time. It doesn't matter if, even if my name wasn't on the list, I would think, what the hell are you doing with your security? I would be absolutely livid about that. So it's unsurprising that that was a huge blow.
Yeah, people were very upset. And to be fair, the ESA, they did take appropriate measures. They took the lists down as quickly as they could. And they also implemented new security measures for the future, as well as making very clear that they are limiting the amount of personal data that they're even going to store at all, because you don't need necessarily all of the information that was on these lists in order to track who's attending and who's not.
Right.
Now, after this, now we come to the next section. I've given it the title, The Pandemic Ends the Show.
Yeah.
Now,
another fatality of COVID.
Yeah, it's really, yeah. It's a series like of pretty heavy blows that E3 took in that time frame. In summer 2020, E3 wanted to return to form. The concept was this time that influencers should have priority in accessing E3, because they were kind of hoping to make it this viral event that would go wild all over social media. However, fairly early on, Sony announced that they would not be participating. They had abstained before, and they just made it very clear, no, we're basically not coming back. We've got our own thing going now. We're very happy with that. Also, 2020 was the year when Geoff Keighley left E3. He hosted some major E3 events, and he dropped out in 2020. He spoke with GamesIndustry.biz at the time. I found an old interview with him where he said the following, quote, "Given what has been publicly communicated about plans for E3 2020, I just don't feel comfortable participating in the show at this time," end quote. He didn't go into much detail, but from his elaborations, also other elaborations in the interview, it's clear that Geoff Keighley was not happy with the way that E3 was progressing, and that he felt like it needed to change. He also had already established the Game Awards, and the Game Awards were growing, so he had his own thing. And he had also increased his presence at Gamescom in Germany, kind of going out on his own path to establish alternative events to E3.
I think there's a conspiracy theory to be had that there's something going on behind the scenes. You could read into that quote from the interview that you read however you'd like. But I think realistically with Geoff Keighley, he just saw the turning of the tide. And yeah, he had his own things going on. And I think I would argue that Geoff Keighley has his pulse, or his finger on the pulse of the gaming industry more so than a lot of people at E3 did. And I think he basically said, yeah, this is done. I'm not going to find any value in this moving forward. I'm going to create my own value. And that's what he's been doing.
I mean, we don't know whether there was something that happened behind the curtains that led him to basically quit E3, but it might not have even been necessary, because he's a smart guy. As you said, he understands video game culture, and he probably he probably anticipated the trajectory of where video game culture and the industry would develop. That's why he initiated the Game Awards, because he found, well, actually, we don't have something like the Oscars, and we can make this a really big thing. He brought some E3 spirit with it to the Game Awards, but as in making it about celebrating the industry and giving out awards on the one hand, but on the other hand, also giving lots of new announcements and stuff. So kind of satisfying this desire for, we want news, we want announcements, we want trailers. But still, E3 was supposed to go ahead, but then the pandemic hit. And the ESA was trying to cling on, as many companies were at the time. This is not an evaluative statement. When in 2020, many companies still believed they could progress as normal, as long as possible. And it was then supposed to take place as a virtual event when they saw, okay, so with this huge crowds, it's probably not going to be a good idea. And then the virtual event was also canceled because, under the assumption, that's at least what I could gather, that there was just, there was not enough time to prepare. They didn't quite know how to pull it off. There was no proper precedent for this. And so they canceled it entirely. And since then, they struggled to find their footing again.
Yeah, it's a big stack of dominoes that kept getting bigger and bigger with every little push. I remember when that happened in 2020, because obviously none of us were doing much more than reading online and playing video games. And when, I think it was a foregone conclusion to me that the in-person show would be canceled, of course, because everything was. But then when that second announcement of the virtual show being canceled came out, I remember thinking, oh, okay, this is maybe a sign of the end.
Yeah, this is not just the pandemic, because they've got infrastructure, they've got technology, they doubtlessly would have, if you look at the huge shows they put on before, it can't be that hard to set up a stage and a camera and put a couple of trailer inserts in there, as Geoff Keighley then did with the Summer Game Fest. But I think that this is really a conflict that had pervaded E3 all this time already. What is it going to be? What is it going to look like? Is it going to be primarily for industry insiders or for the public? Is it going to be a celebration of 500 different video games or a focus on just a couple? All of these things were never really negotiated. And that leads us to the dying breath of E3, which took place in this year, in 2023, where E3 had taken a break for since 2020, actually. I think in the last year, was there an E3?
I don't even remember. Regardless of whether there is, that is a problem.
Yeah, I don't even remember either.
No. I don't think there was. No, it was canceled in 2022.
It was canceled. Okay.
Yeah. You know what I'm thinking back to? I'm thinking back to, like, did Dunkey or Lyle Rath make a video about it on YouTube? And I was like, no. They cobbled together some announcements, but there wasn't an E3 video.
It's also, it becomes hard in hindsight to distinguish, because as soon as the pandemic hit, the Summer Game Fest was established, which basically took the E3 concept, put it into exactly that virtual showcase that we would have expected from E3 with the host Geoff Keighley, and he just basically ran with it and made it big. Now, before we go into that, though, let me briefly elaborate on the cancellation of E3, because this might be the very last chapter in this story. After years of not taking place because of the pandemic, they basically wanted to make a comeback in some form. Nobody really know what it would be. But in the months leading up to it, we already saw how major publishers were drawing out. Major publishers was like Nintendo. No, clearly they wouldn't attend. But even then, Sony, no, thank you. We're kind of doing well as we are.
Major success with their own show. I mean, and imagine the money they're saving on overhead with travel and why would they need E3? They don't.
And how it's tough if you got several of these showcases, including an already established Summer Game Fest, where everyone's attention is going to be. then what are you going to show still at E3? You know, then you have to split things up, then your showcase is not going to be as impressive, stuff like that. In any case, on the 30th of March, 2023, E3 was cancelled for this year, and there's a public statement from Kaylee Marston-Kish at ReadPop, who's, you know, the organizing institution or organizing company of E3. And she says, quote, "This was a difficult decision because of all the effort we and our partners put toward making this event happen. But we had to do what's right for the industry and what's right for E3. We appreciate and understand that interested companies wouldn't have playable demos ready, and that resourcing challenges made being at E3 this summer an obstacle they couldn't overcome." End quote. This was from an interview with Kaylee Marston-Kish from ReadPop at IGN.com.
You know, that's a factor. We're kind of being harsh on E3. I am, anyway, being harsh on the production. But I think that's a really, forgetting all of the sort of public perception of E3 and people pulling out of it, that is a very cogent point, which is the pandemic was really hard on the development of video games, to the point where I think we're still feeling the effects of the lag and of the cancellations or things moving forward without their normal schedule. We're still kind of feeling it. So the sense that, listen, these companies may not even have the games, you know, we don't want to have an empty showcase. It's reasonable.
Yeah, we don't want to have an empty and sad showcase, and companies have to prioritize. And if they know that, well, I mean, that Geoff Keighley basically owns the media industry now, games industry now, they want to show something at the Game Awards, of course. That's where you want to be. And Geoff Keighley is certainly going to approach you and be like, hey, what do you intend to do for the Game Awards?
Real nice video game company you've got here. It'd be a shame if something happened to it.
So, what are you going to do for the Summer Game Fest?
Yeah.
Got any of your major titles going on?
A new Crash Bandicoot, perhaps?
He's actually really fun and really cool. I think he would forgive us poking fun at him.
we're both big fans of Jeff. If you've listened to our episodes on the Game Awards and the Summer Game Fest, I think that he is a proper bearer of the torch for where we are with these kinds of things.
Yeah, the reason for why things work so well for Geoff Keighley, I think, is that he has an authentic passion for video games. E3 always has been this kind of more like, it's a major thing by this industry trade show institution that doesn't really have much of a face or voice. Of course it does, but people don't perceive it as such. And they are rather attracted to someone like a charismatic host like Geoff Keighley, who conveys the genuine passion for video games. And since he has got the events going, and these events are fun. I love to watch the Game Awards, and I'm probably going to enjoy the Summer Game Fest this year. Really enjoyable events. And it's going to be difficult for E3 to make any kind of return. The question is, will that even happen at all? Or was this basically the end? On their website, if you visit it, they just have one simple statement that E3 has been cancelled. It's not taking place this year. And if you want to keep in the loop, then you can sign up for a newsletter.
I think my thought would be that even if it comes back, it would not look the way that we are used to E3 looking. I think it would probably look more like, ironically, CES. I think if E3 were to come back, I think it would be strictly a trade show for years when companies have hardware that they want to sell. Because, as you mentioned, Geoff Keighley, he's the face of this kind of area of the video game world right now. And for really good reason, because outside of like Reggie Fils-Aime showing up at E3, which was always a treat, there wasn't a whole lot of personality or connectivity between people who play the games and the gaming companies. But now you have Geoff Keighley with the Game Awards. You have the higher ups at Nintendo in their Nintendo Directs. You have the developers from like Santa Monica Studios and other huge development teams in the States of Play, or like Yoshi P showing up for Square Enix. It's a much more personal situation with actual like faces of people who are making the games. And I don't think you can go back to, look at this trailer we have. Isn't this exciting?
Yeah, you're probably right. It could be that it could be this trade show. That could be a possibility of saying, we're going to go back to the days of 2007 and 8, and we're going to do an E3 Media and Business Summit. That would still not solve the problem. Oh, let me put it this way. It would solve the problem of having to compete with Geoff Keighley, because he's won this race, you know, and deservedly so. He's done very well for himself. But they couldn't possibly compete. And if they were to do such a trade show, it could be primarily for industry connections. They couldn't possibly focus it so much on announcements, because all of the companies have their own venues already. They communicate with players via their own showcases or through Geoff Keighley, basically.
Yeah.
Those are the two options. And it's hard to squish another player in there. And that's why, I mean, another option is also, but this might be a stretch. I mean, they could also try and establish themselves as a kind of a venue for indie, something between indie and like double A productions, of being like an annual kind of like, you know, E3 indie or something like that showcase, where they do a smaller one. Because indie games often, there are lots of indie games in this world that are still looking for a stage where they can present their stuff. And that might be a possibility.
You know, I love that idea, but as you were describing it, that's what PAX is.
It also exists.
Yep. A PAX in its many forms, whether it's East, West, Australia, PAX Unplugged in Pennsylvania. They kind of have the market covered. That's where they got their start, really, is showcasing indie developers. And that's still a huge thing where, you know, the big AAA developers, maybe there's one or two at PAX, but for the most part, the exciting thing about PAX is going to talk with the indie developers. So I would love to see that, maybe a localized version of it in Los Angeles. But yeah, I think that there's a lot of avenues they could take, but none of them seem to be as big or as exciting as what E3 once was.
So in other words, we can safely assume that E3, as we know it, is dead.
I think so. I think we can chisel in the epitaph on the gravestone, and much like in Back to the Future 3, we can say, shot in the back by Geoff Keighley over a matter of $80.
Yeah. Well, thank you so very much for listening to this episode on the story of E3. Feel free to submit your thoughts and questions by going to studyingpixels.com/contact. And if you want to help us out, then one option to do so is you could go to Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star rating. That's really nice, because it might help us get discovered by a couple more people. Thank you so very much for listening, and see you next week.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.